Gallagher's gonna have the news.
Monday, September 30th. The final day of September.
That was too much drama. I was not prepared.
Sorry, we had to take a quick break. Alyssa said the date so dramatically.
There's too much drama.
The force of it blew me sideways and knocked my coffee onto the floor. Does that now become my LA story?
Yes.
You had to do something this week before the LA story.
That I ruined my friend Hayes.
September
run.
Will go down in history. So
yeah,
it's fitting. It will go down like your coffee.
That was a good allegory for a lot of people's weeks in LA
and elsewhere.
So we could talk about that in a second. Does anyone have an LA story?
I'll just briefly mention something. I've been walking my daughter to school every morning, and it's great, except for the part where we have to cross a major Los Angeles boulevard. And we only have one of those names. Beverly Boulevard.
Yeah.
And we only have one of those flashing signals where you press the button and then pray with every step that the car is going to stop, and you have to go across four lanes of traffic.
You can't even tell if the light, as the person walking, you just hit the button and you have to trust that the lights come on.
I think it might even be configured incorrectly because you should be able to see confirmation that the light is flashing for you. I feel like they set up the bars on the wrong side.
Almost nowhere in LA is.
Yeah.
Is that
okay. Well, now I feel
experience.
A little bit better. And also for us, it's great that it's, I feel, believe me, I feel bad, really bad. The worst part too is you have to go all the way to where the post is to press the button and then walk like 10 feet back to the actual crosswalk. And it's only on one side of the intersection. So you're doing like one of those three intersection crosses to get to the same side on the other side of the street that you were already on.
And also Metro Ferrell has outfitted the beg buttons with a fingerprint scanner so that when Alyssa hits it, it does not respond.
It's like denied.
Yes.
So I've been struggling with this every day. I see almost every day either we get hit or I see another family getting hit because there's a lot of people using it in the morning and there's a bus stop right there. So there's a lot of people need to get from one side to the other to get to the bus stop. And this week, the city installed this like fancy version of this. It's called a hawk flashing signalized crossing thing. Mm-hmm. And they put it by
not
LACMA.
An acronym.
I don't know. They put it by LACMA. So if you're on 6th Street and if you're trying to get from like Park La Brea to that LACMA entrance right there, obviously a lot of people are walking in that area. It's a very walkable area. Mm-hmm. So then now they have this fancy new flashing, I don't even know what to call it. It's a beacon. I think some beacon is one of the terms. So it's
hawks,
a little
hawks
bit.
Have beaks.
Yeah, it's like it's, hawks have like great eyesight to see the cars barreling towards them. So, and I think it's a little bit better. It looks kind of like more like a railroad crossing with like two flashing red lights. And I guess it gives you more of the driver's a preparation to stop by like flashing yellow and then flashing red and then flashing. I don't know. What we know is it's better than nothing, but it's still really bad.
Yeah.
And I can't believe, especially on this little stretch of 6th Street where we were supposed to have a road diet that was supported by the neighborhood council and the people who live in the area and like these major institutions that have enough money to buy a real crosswalk signal, I think. Check LACMA's operating budget, but I'm guessing that we can't actually make the changes to make the street safer and just do this incremental change that we're supposed to celebrate again without actually fixing the problem.
I mean, it's like, it just goes back to like, if the council person doesn't want it to happen, it's not going to happen. And David Root really did not want it to happen. Like that was right there. And
that was the one by LACMA.
6th Street. Yeah. That's a 6th Street one. Yes. Yeah. And I can't see now what happens on 6th Street. Like, yes, the neighborhood council will try to stay committed to do this, but now David Rue or whoever can be like, well, we made the street safer, so we're kind of done here. Yeah.
Yes.
There's no connection to the bike network. You still have to somehow ride on the sidewalk to get through this area. It's no safer for people like a few blocks down where there's been like fatal car crashes. So I just still can't believe we're here. I can't believe this is where we are in this last day of September 2019. And this is what we're doing. And
you're really good at branding. I'm glad I moved my coffee away from me this time.
I'm like thrashing about over here. It made me so upset. And also, David Rue spent money, $80,000, to study the Rowena Road diet, which could have paid for another road signalized diet. Intersection yeah. or road diet.
Yeah. That doesn't and the cost study a lot concluded, of money. Like, it's cool. It's Let's great. Do nothing.
And it's just so frustrating to me. So, yeah, now I'm going to do everything I can to get my intersection fixed to, yeah. you know, make this light better. I don't want the upgraded beacon. I want there to be only two lanes of traffic that I have to cross with my children instead of four.
Right. That's the dream.
Mm. That's the dream, right? That's what we want.
Has he got anything?
I have an LA story that's sort of an Alyssa story. I have had the pleasure of sort of following along Alyssa's journey with jump bikes at least once a week. I get to a text that she's on her way, and then I get a text that the first jump bike she tried to ride failed completely. The second one started a little bit, but then failed.
Wheel fell off halfway yes. here.
This has been like 80% of our group texts
yes.
since I got back from Europe has been the two of you talking about bikes that don't work.
And so I'm more of a scooter guy. The bikes also never work for me, but I'll just give up and ride a scooter. But the jump scooters are throttled at 12 miles an hour compared to 15 miles an hour for the birds and the limes. And they're not throttled in a nice way. The way the jumps work is you'll be at 11.8 miles an hour, and then the bike will speed up aggressively until it gets to 12 or 12.1, and then it will choke itself and slow down.
Isn't it tied
it's
to
almost
their...
like autoerotic asphyxiation, kind of. That's the experience of riding a jump scooter.
Isn't it tied to their stock price, though?
The experience is deeply unpleasant. I have no idea why the speed limit is lower on a jump bike because it's basically telling you that it could go faster, but it doesn't want to right now.
So that one just wasn't broken.
I'm trying to fuck you off.
This is every single one. Every single jump bike I ride does that.
The
back
scooter,
and forth
you mean? Not the
scooter. Sorry, the scooter.
Yeah.
Yes. The birds never have that problem. The limes don't. The limes are really falling apart right now.
I feel
now,
like Jump will be like, we're being punished by the city of LA and like complain about it. And that will
There was like a whole thing in the news this past week about Uber like becoming the operating system for your life. Is Jump part of
yes,
that?
Yes, both Uber and Lyft redesigned their apps this week with the exact same intentions to put like all their functionality in one screen.
Uh-huh.
So you can see the transit, real-time transit. You can see bike scooters, see cars, and it's rolling out slowly. But then Uber also, since they have Uber Eats and like all these other services, that's how they're claiming that they're going to control your life. You could like have anything brought to you or go to them there someplace.
I've deeply feel like this is directly related to them not wanting to pay workers in some way.
Right, they're trying to argue it's that driving isn't their core their core
business.
They're
not primarily drivers. They're also food delivery people and
but I also
all the
kind
other
and slow
people.
Scooter operators.
I just don't know, like, are the bikes and scooters, like, are they still going to be a thing in the future? Jump? Like, it seems like every time you guys go to one of these, it's not working. I've still not tried one, so I don't know. But
it's not their core competency, I would say. Not sure what is at this
point.
Well, the bikes are... Rideability is not a concern.
Yeah, I think the engineering of particularly the bikes has been, like, universally heralded as the gold standard for these dockless bikes.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not maintaining them or make sure they work or where they're supposed to be, I can't see how this is going to work.
I was on my way home from Westwood last night and I saw a man picking up a bunch of scooters. I think that they were limes and throwing them into the back of an unmarked van. I assume he was charging them, but what happened that was really strange. And I was like, Santa Monica and Gardner or something like that in Hollywood area. And we came to a stop at a stoplight and he took out a blowtorch and I was watching him and he took the blowtorch and was just using it on the handlebars. And I just thought to myself, is this a normal part of charging?
That's how you charge it.
Okay, this is now your LA story. Yeah, go on.
This can't possibly be like a standard thing that you have to do to keep these scooters in operation, right?
I mean,
he's from the competition. He's like blasting off the speed limit.
There's a lot of germs on there. I try to keep a little bit of Purell. Some people use
it's just like
torch.
It's like UV light or a blowtorch.
I mean, there was like a second where he was using the blowtorch and then we like made eye contact and I just, no. My window's down.
Now I'm scared that you're in my home.
And I was just like, what? What next?
He's coming for you. Let's talk about a big story this week, a kind of exciting, fun story. This is part of the ongoing feud between the five county supervisors and the sheriff, Alex Villanueva. Historically, this relationship has been pretty friendly. The supervisors sort of defer to the sheriff almost to a fault in some cases, like when the sheriffs are committing crimes that they eventually go to prison for. But right now, as we've talked about many times, the relationship is not in a healthy place, and it has led to sort of an unprecedented moment where the county supervisors, led by supervisors Sheila Kuehl and Hilda Solis, are this week probably going to freeze funding for the sheriff's department. They are responding to a budget deficit that the department is running of about $60 million, which you would think would be the one thing that Alex Villanueva would be doing well, having fired so many high-level people in the in the department. You would think that, like, keeping the budget tight would be one thing that he was doing successfully. Maybe it was Karen Mandoyan's signing bonus. Mandoyan, sorry. But so there's a hiring freeze for non-essential personnel, and they have to get on a payment plan to reimburse the county for excess spending. It feels designed to be as humiliating as possible.
And if you need confirmation for that, just look at Sheila Kuehl's face in the LA Times story about this, which she is looking.
Oh, yeah. She's got the, like, you've got one coming to you, buddy, look on her face.
Like, I never want to be looked at the way that she's looking at him in this picture.
The LA Times story is by Matt Stiles and Elaine Chekmadian. Happy trails to Maya Lau from the sheriff's department beat there. I mean, she did, you know, and Maya Lau wept for there were no more stories about the sheriff malfeasance to break.
I feel like you're absolutely right. This relationship has historically been a good one between the supervisors and the sheriff in terms of lack of open conflict. One of the things that we talk about so frequently on this show is LA politics, at least among the political classes themselves, has been a go along, get along sort of, you know, that has been the governing mood in LA politics, because all of these individuals have so much individual power with so few real checks and, like, balances built into the system. Mm-hmm. There's almost no reason for them to go out of their way to strike up discord with somebody else in some other office. What is the reason? This is something we talked about with Maya Lau last time she was on the show. Like, what is the reason that this has been the breaking point, the point of breakdown for this relationship? I know that the supervisors, Kuehl especially, has been extremely vocal about the way that Sheriff Villanueva is treating his control over the employees under his watch. She's been very vocal that he's not doing a good job with that. But you do kind of wonder, what brought it to this point of rupture between the two of them? I mean, I personally like seeing it.
Yeah, I think it's the only, like, from our conversation with Maya, it's the only tool they really have. Not that they are not warranted to tell him to rein in his budget, but literally this is the only course of action that they can take, because they've been having this, like, public fight for so long. So
at this point, this feels personal,
yeah,
right?
Of course. Yeah,
totally, right?
I was just going to read the Zeb quote.
Oh, the Zeb quote is really good. It's really good.
I'm just going to laugh while I read it. And then the best was Zeb Yaroslavsky, who, it says, historically, every sheriff knew that the board has the ultimate authority to withhold funds from his budget, but no sheriff ever let a dispute get to the point where the board had to exercise that authority. Apparently, there is a new sheriff in town.
Really good. It's really funny. But it's been personal all along. Like, right. This is the result of Villanueva totally unnecessarily trying to flex his authority just to keep a all but fully acknowledged domestic abuser in his ranks, because he was his friend. Tried to, like, allow him to keep a gun. The supervisor said, no, obviously you are not allowed to do this. And he wanted to assert his authority over them. So now they feel that they have this obligation to show that they have power over him.
They do have power over him, but it's it is interesting to watch play out, I think, for that very reason, because it's only in I mean, let's just say if he were not running this budget deficit, if he were not exacting these enormous overtime costs, we're not even, you know, like we're God, what? It's the end of September, as Alyssa was saying. If he were not exacting these enormous costs, not even fully through his first year as sheriff, then they wouldn't have this leverage to act retributively against him. But they do have to go sort of out of their way to make it known that they are trying to basically get him in line, which is, again, what makes it so interesting to watch. I do think that, you know, Villanueva's stock line on this has been, they're politicians and I'm not. And but he, of course, is also
a politician and obviously a decent one.
A decent one. You do have to wonder, like what I keep coming back to with Villanueva, what I keep thinking about is actually like something from the other side of the country when Bill de Blasio took over as mayor of New York and had made comments about the state of the NYPD and the way that it was being run under Bill Bratton and Michael Bloomberg. And when he took over, there was that like really widely publicized incident where the cops all turned their back on him at an officer's funeral. I keep thinking about that because Villanueva seems like he epitomizes this police mentality of like you're either in or you're out.
Yeah.
Of a gang in his, of a sheriff gang.
And he is entirely in. Like, if you think about it, politically, there's not really any benefit for him to wage this fight against the Board of Supervisors. It's not the kind of thing that is going to endear him to voters. Whatever he might think, there's not like a political base in LA that really wants to see their sheriff taking on these sorts of fights with the supervisors. It seems like it is entirely for the benefit of the sworn officers.
Yes.
The deputies.
The one maybe potential valid cost overrun in there that I was just looking at was the Woolsey fire, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the most devastating fire financially for, you know, the county, and probably had to have a bunch of people out there keeping people safe or checking on homes at the mayor's request. Very busy time. But you have to just look at, I mean, what else could you possibly, it's so much money. Like how?
$5 billion.
That's a whole bit. But like this particular overrun, how are you burning through that much money in such, like you said, such a short amount of time? Clearly there is oversight needed. It's not just personal, yes, right? This is a good reason to do this.
I agree with Scott. I think it is going to escalate much like the NYPD fight did. The meeting's on Tuesday at the Board of Supervisors. You should go. Alex Villanueva is going to show up and he's going to try to accuse the supervisors of putting everyone in LA County in danger.
We should all wear like Sheila Kuehl masks and just stare him down.
I would be interested what the contract cities think about this. Of course, a lot of the sheriff's budget comes from the cities in LA County that contract with the sheriff's department for funding. I'm curious, you know, like if that line of defense from Villanueva will appeal to them. We know, of course, a lot of them were unhappy with how the Deputy Mondragon scandal sort of played out, but who knows what they're going to say, whether or not they think that this overtime is warranted in their cities or what have you.
Let's move on to another wacky story. We've talked a lot about the projects paid for by Measure M, the sales tax initiative that was on the ballot in 2016. And like the different projects that Measure M money is going to. It's going to 28 projects to be built by the 2028 Olympics. And it's also going to pay the internet bill in the South Bay. As it turns out from this week, four Metro directors, supervisors Janice Hahn and Hilda Solis, Inglewood Mayor James Butts, and Duarte Councilman John Fasana introduced and have now signed off on a motion to authorize funding for a broadband internet, like a fiber optic project in the South Bay. From this pot of money from Measure M that's reserved for South Bay transportation projects. This thing, when it first came up, Metro was like, oh, no, sorry, you don't understand. This is for transportation. it's for like rail and bus and like sometimes highways and stuff. This is the internet. This is not, obviously not something that you could spend Measure
it
M.
It is the information highway.
Hey. Yeah, they're widening the information superhighway.
Induced demand.
They're adding lanes. And then basically some of these Metro directors went to work justifying this cost of $4.4 million of the sales tax money to improve their internet. And they made the argument that faster internet would create trips not taken. If the internet's faster in the South Bay, then more people will telecommute, and it'll create a way to handle more municipal services digitally. So basically, the government workers, they're saying, won't have to come into work if the internet is faster, and so they will stay home, and that makes this a transportation project.
Yeah. Metro eases traffic. That's their slogan.
They did also talk about they need the Wi-Fi to do something with the signals, traffic signals or something like that. Wasn't that in there too? Like,
I want to point out that everything that you guys are saying is the explanation that they came up with in the 2 months that they gave themselves to come up with a transit relation to spend this money. That was part of the bargain, was that they said this is $4.5 million that they were going to spend on this internet project in the South Bay. It was approved with the understanding that they would have to come back within 60 days and justify it. They had no, this is basically writ very, very small, the Census Bureau question about immigration status, that whole confab that we had over the past couple months where mm-hmm. the administration came out and said, we want to do this because, like, we're stupid racists.
They're like, no, you need
the Supreme Court was like, no, come back and give us a different reason. This is basically that happening here in LA County.
I think they could have come up with something better. I just feel like those are both just not. Well, first of all, let's look at the work from home argument, because interestingly enough, the American Community Survey information came out this week, data about how people in LA County get around.
Mm.
How many people work from home? You guys probably know this.
I don't.
What is it? Like 5%, 10%?
It went up.
Yeah.
The last year from 6.3 to 6.4%. Mm. And you can definitely see a huge increase over the last decade as the internet has gotten better. Not the number of people that work from home is like static. I mean, maybe going up a little tiny bit. The bigger problem is people driving alone, which is chipping out the rail, the bus, the walking, the biking. Yeah.
None of which the South Bay cares about. Like they just want fiber optic. Sure.
Which is not even, this is not like the top of the line. I mean, it's not like 5G or whatever.
Yeah.
This is like
not getting paid for
a generation. Yeah, I'm sure as soon as the broadband, in like 2 weeks, once this broadband network is obsolete.
Well, you could argue that 5G will help you like use your ticketless, your contactless payment thing on your phone, right? That might be a good argument. Yeah. I'm just coming up with other ideas.
I mean, the question is like, why is this happening with, why is Metro doing this? Like, this is so beyond the scope of what Metro is as an agency. Like, why are they paying for the South Bay to upgrade their internet?
I can answer that question for you. It's because the people that make up the Metro board are politicians whose primary interest is not transportation. And what they see when they look at Metro is a stack of money
yeah.
to be used for whatever they can justify.
I will never forget Janice Hahn in the immediate aftermath of Measure M passing. She was not on the board when Measure M went to the ballot, but it was, I think, elected that same day. So she joined shortly thereafter. That what transit spending was all about was jobs. Mm-hmm. Like, we're spending money on transit because jobs. Mm-hmm. That is, in her view, what public transportation is. The only Metro service that she makes use of by her own report is the express lanes getting from the South Bay to Metro's headquarters so that she can attend and you know, barely be engaged at the board meetings and then leave.
Unless
again.
They're siphoning money out of the...
Exactly. but this is really egregious. This is really troubling. And one of the things that was a core concern during the campaign was, how are taxpayers supposed to believe that the money is going to be spent on what yeah. they are voting for it for? The governance structure put in place was that there would be this citizen board. We're so fond of these citizen boards with mm-hmm. no real oversight in LA County. And so there is one for the expenditure specifically of Measure M dollars. Doesn't seem like it has any real power. Meets quarterly, reviews what Measure M money is being spent on. And then if there is an issue, is supposed to report it back to the board
yeah.
who approved the spending in the first place. So we end up in this situation where you can almost guarantee that supervisors Hahn, Solis, Butts, who is now the chair of the Metro Board, and John Fasana are all basically probably thinking it's just $4 million, mm-hmm. you know, out of $120 billion of Measure M money. Who's going to care that much? You know, props to Lauren Elson for reporting this story the way that she did. But you can basically hear that being like, we don't care because it is such a relatively small amount of money. However, it is the same amount of money that Metro used to justify cutting rail service from every 10 minutes after 8 p.m. to every 20 minutes. They did that several years ago for an annual savings of $4 million. So now, you know, we're just handing money over to Janice Hahn's district for no transportation purpose, allowing her to fabricate a transportation purpose ex post facto. And we are continuing to cut service on what Metro actually is supposed to be doing, which is provide bus and rail service to Angelenos.
It's truly heinous. This feels like it should be like the beginning of the third act of the movie where now we have to team up with all the like good government group, like Fix the City and all the people that like have like their like lawsuit bazookas and be like, hey, justice wants we need to put aside our differences right. and sue Metro, not for the normal reasons, but because they are blowing this money on their own personal pet projects. This happening at the same time as Expo service has been cut. I haven't ridden Expo in a while, but the experience has like by all accounts gotten way, way worse. Just from taking the headways down from 6 minutes to 8 minutes, right?
It's so much worse. Like you can tell just on social media that it's packed. And like Steve Hyman, who writes the Metro is the Source blog, used to say, you know, good transit is crowded transit, which is true.
And they're saying that now too. Oh, you're supposed to stand, and like you're supposed to be some people standing, but it's like
Scott's got his finger. Yeah. I just want to show Scott's finger.
Oh yeah, I'm doing the Bernie Sanders. So it is true. Good transit is crowded transit. However, bad transit can also be crowded transit, and that is unfortunately where we're at. You know, if you have really good service and a lot of people are making use of it, like I saw when I was in Paris last month, that is, you know, that's one thing, and it can encourage local leaders to continue to improve transit. However, if those local leaders, as we see here, are cutting service, people are already frustrated with the decline in service quality, and also they are being forced into substandard conditions on the train. If they can get on the train, they are not going to stay. Like, they're not going to continue doing that.
Yes.
And so then you end up with the situation that we had with the Blue Line over the past several years before they shut it down. The A Line.
Never.
They are losing, like, the Blue Line lost 30,000 plus riders daily. Daily riders, 30,000 out of the 90,000 that it had in 2013. Over the course of the past 5 years, it lost that many riders because the quality of the ride declined that much. So that's what happens when transit quality goes down. You lose people and they don't come back. And that is what we're, I think, definitely going to see. I the problem with your third act theory, I just want to point out, is that what group is Jill Stewart with these days? I can't keep track anymore.
Livable at Los Angeles.
Yeah,
Livable. Is Coalition to Preserve LA just gone?
I don't even know. Still around.
Coalition to Preserve LA.
They're the one who did the...
Jill,
the
this movie. Actually, the argument that they came up with actually aligns with her thinking on public transit in LA. Namely, that it does not work and we should instead incentivize people to work from home. Yeah. So for her, using Metro as just a giant fucking... What is the term, Eva? It's like a slush fund. Slush.
Yeah.
Where you would encourage people through various tax refunds and other
buy snacks for people to
fill Angelenos refrigerators with LaCroix. So they
now
can
that,
work from home.
That is a good use of Measure M funds. I the work from home thing too, I mean, we talk about this a lot. I mean, we should encourage people to, you know, especially the employers, to do like TDM projects where you do something like carpooling or getting people to work on flexible schedules or all these other things to shift people away from being in cars. But there was this headline this week, and I was just looking up, and it was one of those like studies that's done by like a company to be like, oh, you should, you know, pay attention to us because we're doing the study, but it was saying that like 25% of Angelenos surveyed had left a job because their commute was so bad. So it's not that people are deciding to work from home because they can. They actually can't work from home and they're just quitting their job and they're just because they can't drive or take the transit for that long.
I've done that. I mean, like I had
Everybody's done it at least once. It's not like a groundbreaking thing.
No. But it is something where, it's like, gonna drive all the way across town every day or further for a job that probably is not paying you well enough to like make ends meet in a good way. It's like,
or you have to move so far that what we've talked about before, that the job is no longer tenable and you have to find a new situation. But that's what the work from home argument is. Just it's a very small number of people that can do it, and they probably are, and the numbers aren't going up substantially since we now have this great telecommuting culture,
right?
So let's just let that one go and let's focus on the 75% of people driving alone to work.
Yeah. I mean, Metro is really behind the gun on this. You were talking about demand management and they're also not leading on that. Like we saw with the 710 North, the highway gap closure that they had been trying to do for whatever, 50 years between South Pasadena and Alhambra, that project was finally killed last year. And John Fasana, Metro board member, was on the record as saying like, this is not the future of our county, which is great to hear. However, now they're taking the money that Metro had set aside for that project and they are redistributing it within that specific part of the San Gabriel Valley. But what they're doing with it is they're expanding arterial streets. They're doing these types of road widenings that are, like Alyssa was talking about at the top of the show, going to make it basically like unworkable for people to be pedestrians. And they're going to just try to accommodate all of the traffic that they can. So we're not doing the demand management stuff either. We're just basically doubling down.
There's one good pilot program at NBC Universal in the Valley that they've actually, that Metro is working with, and they have shown that people have shifted their trips. But, and this is also, I will say, it's not just for people who work at like the studios there. It's also for people who work at Universal Studios, like the theme park. So they've been able to do, they're expanding the pilot program and doing a lot of these things. They're figuring it out, but it's really hard to do these things. And they kind of have to be customized per, you know, per like workplace. And they really have to go in. And so they're figuring out what works, but we need something at like the state level. I mean, we need like something that's like really going to incentivize these big employers, especially like places like the tech companies that are in like Playa Vista. Like finally we have like, you know, a LA DOT, you know, commuter bus that's serving some of these areas out there. But like, we have nothing in place that forces these companies to do this.
This week, 4118 was back in front of the city council. We have talked about it over the last few weeks. This was the part of the LA Municipal Code that was struck down by the 9th District Court of Appeals because it prevents people from sleeping on the side, makes it illegal to sleep on the sidewalk. And the 9th District said it's unconstitutional to do that. It's cruel and unusual punishment if you don't have places for people to go to sleep, which LA definitely does not. The city council, specifically Councilmember Mitch O'Farrell, brought up new language produced by the city attorney that would restrict the amount of sidewalk space that people could sleep on and not say it was illegal to sleep on the sidewalk anywhere, but definitely almost everywhere.
Yep.
Within 500 feet of parks, new shelters, schools, school routes, within 10 feet of any driveway entrance. And it also contained language policing speech, specifically for people who are homeless, that you're not allowed to, for example, address someone in a way that could cause them to commit violence against you. It came out of the Homelessness and Poverty Committee. It went back in front of city council this week. Herb Wesson brought this up for just a conversation, not a vote, a conversation in front of the public.
Interesting.
On Tuesday. It is interesting. I could do some on-location reporting. I went to this.
Live from the scene.
Yes. I went to this hearing to represent CELA. I signed up to give public comment, and they didn't get to me because they only gave people 20 minutes total for everyone to comment on this. But everyone who showed up, it was unanimously against the new language of 4118, talking about how this like criminalization just makes homelessness worse.
I heard on Twitter that O'Farrell brought out the same line of defense that you had heard previously at a neighborhood council meeting where he said, well, you guys want us to make it more strict than
this? Yeah, because it used to be more strict until, of course, the federal government, the judicial system got in and said, hey, this is unconstitutional. But he's like, okay, I guess you want us to go back the thing that was worse before.
So he's really trying it, and it did not really pay off.
No, it did not take. So everyone in public comment just lined up to rail against this thing. And then the really interesting thing was Herb Wesson opened it up to the council members to talk about it. And it was basically like a Harlem Globetrotters game if the Washington Generals only got one player. And the Globetrotters got like 10. The council members just sort of got in line to just dunk on Mitch one by one.
It was like he was in the stocks and they were just kicking him in the seat of the pants, basically.
Yeah. And this is, like, I think it's a reflection of a couple of things. One is I have been amazed at how much the conversation on homelessness has moved in the last just few months.
Yeah.
The way the council members talk about it is different.
Yep.
It started with Mike Bonin among the council members speaking out against 8502. But what used to be, it was not that, it was like, I feel like in August, homeless criminalization policies would basically sail through the council.
Yeah.
And now it's a product of, A, one council member speaking up and making the rest of them look bad, which rarely ever happens. And two, these activists showing up to these meetings and screaming at them for what they're up to. And also like things like the LA Times editorial board. There has been a movement on how this stuff is talked about. And so now council members that used to be very willing to pass criminalization policies are like standing up and saying like enough is enough. And it's like, well, you are the ones who have been doing this, but sure. Great.
Yeah. Like you have Gil Cedillo leading the cavalry. Well, that's just like unfathomable this time last year. I agree with you. Like the activism groups like CELA and K-Town for All and LA Can. Yeah. Like the entire Services Not Sweeps Coalition.
Yes.
Has really moved the needle on this. When you think about it, policies like 4118 are entirely indefensible. But the way that they would get passed is by just no one being aware of them. Like if a council member actually is forced to defend 4118, they sound ridiculous. The way that Mitchell Farrell sounds ridiculous saying it's better than the alternative. Why are you guys being so cruel and unsympathetic? Well, I'm just trying to do a good thing for our unhoused neighbors. It sounds insane when you are actually forced to defend it. The way that these things get through is because nobody is forcing them to defend it.
Yes.
So I think that is what has changed in
and
large
they
part.
They can't say the actual reason, which is the actual reason that they want to pass something like this, which is when homeowners and basically the only people who vote call them and say get rid of this encampment, they need some recourse to do that. They feel they have to be able to do something, because if the encampment stays, then that homeowner is gonna tell all their friends not to vote for them. Like that's all it really comes down to, is being able to be responsive to what they feel is their only constituency, which is homeowners. Who complain about encampments.
Is O'Farrell the one, too, who was saying that, I think that this was his quote, that people are traumatized? Housed people are traumatized by encampments?
He said housed people are traumatized by encampments.
And
yes.
This is like in a 2-month period where we've had like literally 3 different encampments either be firebombed or their residents.
More than that. I feel like there was another
fire.
One just the other day.
There was another one. There was one in Van Nuys.
Several in the Valley.
Yeah, immediately after O'Farrell made that comment. And it's just like that. It is so that this is kind of where you end up when the vote is taking place, where it's like you can either be on the side of Mitch O'Farrell, who is making these just bafflingly inhumane statements. That line becomes really hard to hold when you are being when you're being faced by people who actually are working to improve the lives of homeless people and homeless people themselves and the formerly homeless, which is now a large constituency in LA. This is a problem that touches a lot of people's lives, and a lot of people are becoming involved in the struggle to fight for the rights of the homeless. It becomes much harder for city council to lie about unhoused people.
So it looks like this thing is basically dead, at least in this form. Mitch got up afterwards. It was sort of pathetic to behold. He got up at the end and was like, well, it doesn't look like there's much appetite to solve this problem on city council. And I don't see you all coming up with any ideas. So it looks like this is going away for a while. It was fun to watch. I would be remiss to not bring up something I mentioned before, which is that while I appreciate all these council members speaking up against this thing, if the three of them who led the charge in the first place against 4118, Mike Bond and David Rue and Marquise Harris Dawson, had voted no when this came up in committee, in the Homelessness and Poverty Committee, which they are all on, Mike Bond and what was not there for that vote, but Rue and Harris Dawson were.
Right.
Then we
have avoided all of this.
We would not have had to waste everyone's time, all these activists having to spend 3 hours out of their day to go down to City Hall and tell people not to make this problem even worse. If you can imagine anyone like in the House who's on a committee saying, like, if a Republican puts up a certain policy that they don't like in committee and they say, like, well, like, I'm not crazy about this, but I'd like it to see, like, debate on the, like, on the floor. You're like, what is wrong with you? Use your power. If you don't like this, kill it in committee. Like, but this is part of the culture of city council that's it's go along to get along. And so, like, stuff just, like, sails through and it's about, like, debate and all that. But there was a big risk in passing this onto the floor. There were at least four votes locked in for 4118. And like, while Wesson probably didn't want a really divisive vote on it, and like, wouldn't it have let it get through that way? Like, that was very chancy to pass it through committee.
Well, so now we end up though in a situation where, so this is good that 4118 is dead, at least in this form. But what we do have to worry about going forward is that the county and the city have both filed amicus briefs with the Supreme Court to basically, hopefully, in their view, get the Supreme Court of the United States to overturn this Ninth Circuit decision that we've been talking about, the Boise case. So the city attorney, Mike Feuer, who we've talked a lot about as having mayoral ambitions, as well as three members of the Board of Supervisors, are hoping that the conservative Supreme Court will rule that cities have no obligations to homeless people.
Yes.
That is essentially what they are saying with the briefs that they filed.
Mm-hmm. And I think if this manages to get to the Supreme Court, they will be proven right.
That will be the verdict handed down.
Yes. I mean, there's a question of whether they would take it up, but if they did, this Supreme Court would allow sleeping on the sidewalk to be criminalized universally.
You can definitely see the appeal for the Supreme Court to handle this particular issue, because it does touch upon specific, like, human rights issues, civil rights issues, and where does the line of responsibility fall between the city service providers and people who live in the cities. And I don't think that we're going to like the answer that Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch have on that question. Yes. I mean, you can almost guarantee it. But it's like, why is this something that Mike Feuer, who came out strongly in defense of 4118, feels like this is going to be good for the city of LA? You don't see it really turning out well for us.
It's a weird thing that's happened as the rest of LA's elected officials, or most of them, are taking a kinder, gentler position about, like, increasing services and not criminalization. Feuer has gone the other way. It's a weird thing that's happened with him. Yeah. Basically, since he started campaigning for mayor, through a combination of self-owns and, I guess, Oppo research being distributed, it's just like disaster after disaster for him. Also this week, they had to throw out the case against the DWP, the PricewaterhouseCoopers rate-paying case. Ratepayers were charged hundreds of millions of dollars more than they were supposed to be. This has led to City Hall being raided because the lawyers involved in the case had represented both sides of it and were taking money from both sides. And it has led to the case being thrown out completely, which means that LA ratepayers are still on the hook for these hundreds of millions of dollars. And that is entirely because of mismanagement by the city attorney's office.
Oof. Yeah, I mean, and he is. So in terms of the homelessness issue, he is he has at least two Democrats who are in the same boat as him. Those being Mark Ridley Thomas, 2nd District Supervisor, and Janice Hahn, who I believe is District 4.
Yeah.
They both signed on to Catherine Barger's motion to file the amicus brief for the county.
And Mitch O'Farrell is doing the same thing, by the way. And a lot of these are people who are talking about running for mayor.
I think that what a lot of this comes down to, possibly from Feuer's perspective, is in a mayoral race, hoping to just draw from a large enough pool of people who don't give a shit about the rights of homeless people, and that he would be able to be elected on the strength of that alone. You have Catherine Barger, of course, representing the only truly conservative supervisorial district in the county at this point, Hahn and Mark Ridley Thomas as well. They're like all saying things to the effect of, we can't stand by and do nothing anymore. So apparently by logical extension, we're going to jump from doing nothing to doing the worst conceivable thing, and hoping that the conservative Supreme Court will make it possible for us to act, you know, with recrimination against our own constituents. But this is still a troubling undercurrent of current Angeleno politics that I think, Mark Ridley Thomas, as we talked about, sits on this, you know, strike force or whatever for the governor that is supposed to be handling issues of homelessness. And if that is the mentality that we're going to see coming out of that task force, then it's hard to imagine any kind of positive solutions being worked out at the state level, which is also good.
Especially because they keep fighting for emergency powers at the state level. And based on what they want to use their power to do, it seems like declaring a state of emergency would allow them to increase sweeps, would like a lot of increased conservatorship and 5150 people like take away their right to decide what kind of treatment they need. Like it could lead to some pretty scary stuff. However, I think it's great that we're having this out in public. Like the supervisors and the council members don't really do this stuff. And now they're like publicly debating this kind of thing, which I've wanted to see for a long time. Let's talk about signal preemption. If you've ever been on the expo line, which we talked about earlier, you know that there's a period where it just will inexplicably like slow down and stop intermittently around the middle of the line. It has to stop for lights for cars going north-south to pass. But and previously, Scott can talk about this. They brought up the idea of signal preemption. It has kind of been dismissed, but now it looks like there's some movement on it, so to speak.
This is interesting because, again, this is an area where there has been really a popularly led movement to improve Expo Line service. As we talked about, this is directly related to the cutting of service. Metro did an entire rhetorical backflip trying to sort of in the same vein as Mitch O'Farrell be like, well, we cut service to improve rider experience. Do you want us to make the rider experience worse? We had to do this so that we could guarantee that the trains were running on time. So they cut Expo Line service by 25% as soon as the Expo Line reopened following the new blue work in downtown LA. And of course, the condemnation has been widespread on social media. But one of the things that has come out of that is increased attention by the top levels of Metro staff and Metro board members to the speed of the Expo Line, which is something that we haven't really heard them talk about in several years. The core of the issue is that most of the first phase of the Expo Line, which was built from 7th and Metro Street in the financial district to Culver City, most of that runs at grade. That was sort of an artifact of not having enough money to do the grade separations when Measure R passed in the mid-2000s.
Grade separating meaning that it would run above or below street level.
Correct. So most of the Expo Line runs at street level. This is something that we see also at the end of the line in Santa Monica for some part of the way, except the difference in Santa Monica is that they have the train lowering arms that actually go down whenever the train is approaching so that cars have to stop. We don't have that in the first phase of the line. So trains stop at red lights. A lot of them, 30 of them, by the count of,
and it feels like it.
It really does. when you're going, in particular, when you're coming into downtown LA, you just stop every like 200 to 500 feet, and it feels like torture. You're just
like riding a jump scooter,
and it's you can especially feel it right now because the blue line isn't coming into downtown right now. The blue line is closed from like Compton North, so. So sometimes when they're both running, you're stopping for the other trains to go by too. So you may excuse that a little bit. But right now when you ride the Expo Line, you can every single stop because of cars.
So now what we have because of this, the SOS Expo hashtag that has been going on social media and has become sort of a black eye for Metro's public relations. Although what's not
after they literally asked for it because
at first I thought it was So-So Expo.
So-So would be an improvement.
I think when Laura was writing the article about Expo Line service getting cut, someone on Metro said that they had not received any feedback on it. And Mike Bonin got on Twitter and was like, hey, does anyone have feedback about this that they'd like to give Metro? And people did.
At the most recent Metro board meeting, they had discussions about the declining service quality there. They're talking about restoring fully the service that was cut. As we mentioned earlier, Mike Bonin also, though, was saying that he was going to put a motion in LA City Council to explore signal preemption fully along the Expo Line. Now, what that means is everywhere that all of those 30 intersections where the train is expected to wait for red lights along with cars, that anytime a train was approaching, the light would automatically shift in favor of the train. This is something that, Hayes, as you alluded to at the top, that the city has been really reluctant to even admit is a possibility. They actually had, when Salita Reynolds, the current GM for LADOT, was first brought on board to like great fanfare. And, you know, she is this wonderful livable streets advocate, or at least, you know, she would be if she were not shackled by the by the city. She was brought here. And one of the first things that she did after she got her footing was a Reddit Ask Me Anything thread, and got a number of questions about the performance of the Expo Line. This was back in like 2016. And somebody asked her directly, like, why do we have to stop at every red light? You know, you have an Expo Line train with 300 people on it compared to cars going in parallel or in perpendicular directions that are, you know, maybe a sixth of that number of people are waiting. There shouldn't be any question that the train should get priority always. And so Salita Reynolds' response was basically to cast doubt upon the desirability of doing something like signal preemption by saying, if we allowed trains to go whenever they were approaching a signalized intersection in downtown LA, pedestrians would never be able to walk across there. And I think that this was basically the city line, and it's embarrassing. And now, like, we have kind of confirmation that it was just that city council has not wanted this to happen. They don't want this fight between prioritizing transit riders who I'm just going to say they don't think are as valuable to them personally, many of whom don't even come from the city of LA, and drivers. They're not willing in large part to stick up for them. So it's good that we are possibly seeing movement on this, although I expect it will still be a fight by virtue just of the luck of geography. We're talking about, you know, Herb Wesson's district and Curran Price's district and not Paul Koretz. So there is a possibility that we might be able to see something good happen here. This is the kind of thing, though, that if you didn't have to wait at streetlights in the Expo Line train, that could save you like 8 to 10 minutes on your Expo Line trip, which is absurd. Like, that's a huge amount of time.
And now when you compare that to commuting by car, like, now it can be a pretty tight race end to end, like, depending on how thick rush hour traffic is. If you could get from downtown to Santa Monica in 25 minutes instead of 35, that's a huge difference.
So the Expo Line end to end takes 50 minutes.
Okay.
So
it's supposed to be 47, right?
Is that like the,
I mean, that's what they're aiming for. Does it ever?
It is almost never that good. Yeah. And it is frequently actually worse. And now that they've increased the waiting time, it's worse still. But yeah, so 50 minutes, if you could get that down to 40, that is actually still...
Now you're beating cars.
Quite competitive.
Yeah.
The thing is that Metro often falls into this trap where it's competitive at rush hour or like close enough.
Right.
But then outside of rush hour, it's nothing.
Yeah. Like getting the brake speed off.
Exactly.
One thing that the whole odd and even numbered... like headways was really interesting to learn about. And also knowing, I mean, which I know and which I keep kind of forgetting, is that our light rail can't add more capacity. You know, they can only run 3-car trains. They can't extend the platforms. It's all just like this very, it's basically like an articulated bus that runs with traffic in from to the beach. You know, it's like an amusement park ride. But we have to like think about the bigger thing I was reminded of on Twitter and him trying to wrap my head around. The Expo Line was like just supposed to be like a bonus. Like, we were supposed to have the subway finished to Santa Monica via the Purple Line. And that has been held up and that has been delayed. And that is, it has lawsuit, you know, all this kind of stuff. And until we have that part of the puzzle complete, the Expo Line with the most online people riding it is going to continue to be this thorn in the side, you know.
Absolutely.
And if it's that bad on the expo line, how bad are like the buses that no one, there's no like, there's no SOS for like the 704 bus or this, you know, these buses that are incredibly crowded and stuck in traffic. Yeah,
they're doing badly right now.
It's good evidence that the expo line riders that clearly have good internet service
are still taking the expo line.
Well, that's a good reason to invest in.
I will say too, the one thing that we could always do to increase capacity is like if you actually take the expo line, like the seating takes up a huge amount of space in the individual cars, and that is very like different if you go to other places. Right. There's a lot more space reserved for people to stand,
right?
And that is probably something that we should be considering doing because
that I don't understand at all. I mean, why would we not? Why did we plan this transportation system to just be like for a few people for fun instead of heavy duty commuting throughout the city? Because but the train thing, maybe I understand because we're doing light rail and we also are playing the subway, but the inside of those cars, I mean, the great thing about Laura Nelson's story was that it talked about this mom traveling with her kid, which is like, it's so true. If you're on there with little kids and like people do not give you their seats, nobody ever is nice about it on the train. Buses, yes, but it's very, very scary. And then your kid gets freaked out and you know, it's really a horrible experience. But it's not that hard to make it like New York subway seating style, which makes everything a lot better. And it makes you have visible eyes on people so you know who to help or who to give up your seat for. I mean, it's not just a spatial thing, but it's also just about the culture of your subway car in a way. And the seating could change that a lot.
Also, if you're on the inside seat against the window and you would like to get up for somebody to give them your seat, it's too much of an ordeal even bother. You'd have to like climb over someone. They have to climb over you. Yeah, just put them up against the wall. Yep. I want to talk briefly about a story from Riverside involving an off-duty LAPD officer. We talked about this at the time. After an altercation at a Costco, an LAPD officer was knocked down by a man with a disability. The officer was holding his toddler and was knocked over by the man. And then the man's parents were like pushing him away and saying that he has a disability. We're sorry, please don't do anything. And the officer drew his gun, and it turned out 3.8 seconds, shot the man, Kenneth French, shot both of his parents, fired 10 shots. Four of them missed completely and just flew around the store, shot them all in the back. The mother had to have 7 surgeries. There were a lot of articles written in the LA Times about this. The father had to have his kidney removed, and Kenneth French died. This week, the Riverside DA announced that they will not be pressing charges at all. A grand jury decided that that was not something that they wanted to do. Grand juries famously sort of make decisions.
Never indict.
Yes. Especially if the DA isn't interested. The DA could still press charges, but has said that he is not going to do that. The thing that this is relevant about the case now is that it's up to the LAPD to finish their review process. And I think a lot of people are going to be watching and saying, okay, the Riverside DA decided that this officer acted appropriately by being pushed down and drawing his gun and firing 10 shots into a Costco, shooting 2 people not involved in the altercation at all and killing an unarmed man with a disability. What is Michael Moore and the LAPD going to say about what to do with this officer? He's at home now. He's not on the job right now. They put him at home while they do the investigation. There's going to be a lot of people watching for how they decide this case.
This is like it's murder, but it's like the only question is whether or not the judicial system feels like it is important to hold police officers accountable for murder. Like if anybody else in any other situation were to respond in this way, it's not like it's not 1860s Wild West. Like you can't just pull out your gun and start shooting in a grocery store because somebody touches you in a way that you don't like, pushes you over. It doesn't matter. Like it's like this is
and was not like on top of him or anything at the time of the shooting. He was being pulled. He was 20 feet away at the time the shooting started. And the officer also or his attorney also appeared to have misled about what actually happened. The officer Salvador Sanchez said that he had been knocked unconscious, but
In the initial report.
Yes, yeah. That he started shooting immediately. And he said when he woke up, he was fighting for his life, even though the guy was pretty far away from him at that point.
I would love to see initial news reports about police shootings be even a little bit skeptical of.
This is an LA Times issue.
The direct report from the officers, because that was in there as though it were fact that he was unconscious.
they quote the lawyers when they say these things, but there's an amount of credulity that is probably not owed at this point. The LA Times published a video that the LAPD released in the Costco. It is really traumatic to watch. The parents drop first. It appears that the officer shot both of Kenneth French's parents before killing Kenneth French. So we'll wait and see how long the investigation takes and what the conclusion is. That is LA Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I think we're talking about a guest next week. Alyssa, you're out. I shouldn't tell people that. People aren't going to listen if you're not going to be around next week. please come back when we do our next episode. Bye-bye. LA Podcast. LA Podcast. LA Podcast gonna have